Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives. And this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. At this time, I'd like to introduce you, our listeners, to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. He's an award-winning author based in South Carolina. He's the author of 31 books, including Queenpins, Notorious Women Gangsters from the Modern Era, and the just-published Straight from the Hood, Amazing But True Gangster Tales. He's also the producer of two award-winning documentaries. Get out there and buy these books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Ronnie's also a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. Go to strategicmediabooks.com. Also, be sure to visit his website at www.ronchepsik.com. I'll spell you his last name, C-H-E-P-E-S-I-U-K. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Ron is also a two-time Fulbright Scholar, recipient of Bangladesh and Indonesia. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, which happens to be my hometown as well, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last December, he published a book titled Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. And early next year, he'll also publish a book about the famous Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport in Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is selling like hot tamales. Thank you very much. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's featured guest tonight is Sylvia Longmire, author of the page-turner of a book titled Cartel, The Coming Invasion of Mexico's Drug Wars. Having followed Mexico's cartels for years, border security expert Sylvia Longmire takes us deep into the underbelly of the deadly world to witness a dangerous underground that will do whatever it takes to deliver drugs to American consumers. The cartels have grown increasingly bold in recent years, building submarines to move up the coast of Central America and digging elaborate tunnels that move drugs north and carry cash and U.S. high-powered assault weapons back to fuel that ghastly drug war. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some of the mail we received over the past week, I'd like to thank our many listeners out there for tuning into Crime Beat. You know, there's no turning back the clock now. Well, you know, we're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and a couple not so positive, but you know what? We'll take the good good with the bad. And there's a lot of thumbs up for the program, and you know, we're averaging over 130,000 listeners every week now, and it's certainly something to cheer about. You know, I'd like to thank all our production people at Artist First World Radio, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony for making the show possible. Like I said many times before, Ronnie, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Now, here's this week's mailbag. Hey, Ronnie. This one is from Cornelius of that great state of Mississippi. He writes, I listened to your show with Llewellyn Smiley. She describes her father, Alan Smiley, as someone who was good buddies with that snake, Bugsy Siegel. I bet you a bag of nickels, even though he was Siegel's friend, I bet he never trusted that piece of garbage. Ronnie, that's pretty strong words from this listener in Mississippi. Any remarks?
Boy, they have strong opinions in Mississippi, don't they? Yeah, well, you know, Llewellyn did defend the gangsters as being good for the community. Of course, we, you know, disagree with that. And Bugsy was was a snake in many ways. But I'm glad he listened into the interview, and I'm glad our our programs are generating strong emotions. That's better than
Absolutely.
No emotion at all, right?
Absolutely. And we welcome his comments and any kind of comments that you have out there. And we really enjoy the listening or reading your letters. Now, this one is from Llewellyn Smiley herself. She writes from her home in New Mexico in response to your note thanking her for being a great guest on her show. She writes, "Ron, I don't think I was at my best. My life is dicey right now, but you both were so adaptable to me. I thank you for that. I listen to your shows, and they're really fabulous. You keep throwing the dice on crime because criminals have the best stories to tell." Hey, Ronnie, that's great. Any comments?
Yeah, I love that, throwing the dice on crime. We haven't thrown any snake eyes yet, right?
Just no snake
7 come 11, and we rolled them right on that then. But she was a great guest.
Absolutely. We really enjoyed her company, that's
right.
For sure. Well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show, and what have you been up to, what are you going to be doing in the next week or two? I hear you're going to be a pretty busy guy. You're going to do some work with a TV series, aren't you?
Right. I'm being interviewed tomorrow by the Starz Channel for a new series called Magic City, which is a 10-part series that focuses on Miami in the late 1950s in its heyday.
Wow.
And they're going to do a documentary to go with this series. I guess they're trying to duplicate the success of Boardwalk Empire. And I'm going to be interviewed
Great
for
show.
This documentary. I did a book called Gangsters of Miami. So I'll be talking about Meyer Lansky and some of the mob figures. And it's going to be quite interesting. I should also mention that Frank Matthews' documentary is almost done. I know a lot of people are interested in that.
Absolutely.
And we'll be releasing it pretty soon, and hopefully we'll make some waves for it. And we've got some new books out, one by J. Patrick O'Connor on Scapegoat. It's a death penalty case in California, just released, and people can go to strategicmediabooks.com for more information. Go ahead.
Give us a little highlight of next week's show, please.
Right. Next week we got Evan Wright, who's going to talk about American Desperado, my life from mafia soldier to cocaine cowboy to secret government asset. And it's the biography of John Roberts, who we are hoping to have on the show, but unfortunately he passed away December 28th of cancer. But I read the book, and it's an incredible book about the Colombian drug trade and the Medellin cartel. And this guy's incredible life, and I think it's being made into a movie. So we're really looking forward to that interview with Evan Wright next week. Willie?
Well, yeah, it's going to be a great interview, a great show. I'm really excited about that show. Now, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet features a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Here is this week's rap sheet item number 1. Dateline, February 2nd, 2012. Hartford, Connecticut, USA. 4-year-old boy pulls up marijuana at school snack time. Hey, Ronnie, a pre-kindergarten boy who announced to his teacher at snack time that he wanted to share pulled out 9 bags of marijuana out of his jacket pocket. In the apparent sleepy town of Meridian, Connecticut, some 20 miles south of Hartford, police reported they were called to Hanover Elementary Public School after the 4-year-old special needs student displayed the neatly packed cachet of pot. Hey, Ronnie, this one takes the cake. Can you imagine what the kid's parents thought about all this?
Oh, I wonder what the kid's parents had to do with it, right? I mean, a 4-year-old kid shows up in school with 9 bags of marijuana. He's trying to please the teacher. He pulls it out. And what's really interesting is the principal, a guy named Miguel Cardona, he called it extremely unfortunate and isolated incident that was not witnessed by any other students. I don't know what witnessing would have done, because if you're 4 years old, I doubt very much you know what marijuana is. But they're investigating, and it's quite it's going to be quite interesting to what they are going to uncover from their investigation. But just
goes to show you that marijuana is so pervasive that even a 4-year-old kid can get his hands on
right.
9 bags of pot, man.
Right, nine bags of marijuana. That's just, it's really amazing.
Absolutely. Well, we'll keep an eye on that story. Well, here is rap sheet item number 2. Dateline, February the 5th, 2012. Portland, Oregon. U.S. citizen prevented from returning home. A U.S. family is in shock after their husband and father had been prevented from returning home by the FBI. I just don't think anyone should be subject to this, especially not my dad, said Lena Tarhouni, Jamal's daughter. Jamal Tarhouni is a 55-year-old Oregon businessman, a naturalized U.S. citizen who was refused entry into the United States when he attempted to board a flight from an airport in Tunisia. Hey, man, Ronnie, you know what? This is becoming a police state or what? Citizens will be afraid to leave the country.
Well, I'm telling you, I did some research on this story, and it's like something out of Franz Kafka, the trial, because it's just really strange. You know, I'm a naturalized citizen, so I could identify with this Tarhouni. You know, I was in Bangladesh when the Iraq War broke out in 2003. I wrote several articles critical of U.S. policy and the Bush administration, and which turned out to be true. And you know, I could see myself not getting back into the States, and you know, not having any recourse. And evidently, he claimed that they were going to force him to sign a paper without reading it before taking a lie detector test, and he refused to do that. So anyways, I guess he's trying to get back into the country, right, Willie?
Yeah, well, he's scheduled to come back on the 13th of February, and we're going to keep an eye on this one. You know, civil liberties are taking a big hit here. I guess Ron Paul is going to have a field day with this.
Well, you know, Ron Paul's son, you know, who's in Congress, had an incident with the TSA himself. That was well-publicized a little while ago. But, you know, the no-fly list is like 21,000 now, and it's doubled in the last year. And there's 500 Americans on that list, and so we'll see if he gets back in. But the Muslim American groups are petitioning the Justice Department to investigate. It sounds like a really strange case, because I could find no evidence that that this guy had anything to do with terrorism. You know, he's a naturalized he's a Libyan by birth, and he's been back to Libya and to celebrate the overthrow of Gaddafi, and he's worked for a Christian group and a nonprofit, and that supplied provided supplies to Libya. So it's really a strange case. We'll keep an eye on it.
Well, he's become a target. A lot of these guys have become targets because of the all the stuff that's going on in that part of the world. We'll keep an eye on that story. Now, just before we get on to, with our very featured guest, Ms. Sylvia Longmire, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy the show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chapsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on the Internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have any questions for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you, and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, tonight's special guest is Sylvia Longmire, author of Cartel, The Coming Invasion of Mexico's Drug Wars. Longmire offers fresh insights into almost every facet of the war on drugs. If you want to know more about this deadly world of Mexico's criminal underworld, this is the place to be tonight. Sylvia Longmire was a special agent in the Air Force and a senior intelligence analyst for the state of California. She's been interviewed on Geraldo at Large, CNN, CNN International, BBC World Radio, and her writing is regularly featured in Homeland Security Today magazine. Now it's time. It's Crime Beat's chance to ask the questions in this fascinating story. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Sylvia Longmire.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Great. Your book was really fascinating. I believe it was released in December, right?
September, late September.
Oh, it was September, right. How's it doing?
I think it's actually doing pretty well. Taking a look at the numbers through my publisher, it's got steady sales going, and it was actually recently nominated for a Los Angeles Times Book Prize.
Wow.
So I'm optimistic.
Well, that's a prestigious award on that. Have you got any response from our elected leaders? Because, you know, I've been watching the Republican debates, I've been listening to Obama, and, you know, they never talk about Mexico. I mean, what's going on? You know, when they talk about Mexico, it's usually the illegal immigration, never about the drug war. And when something appears in the media, it's always a big bust, which we both know means nothing,
right.
Really. So, are they getting any response from our leaders?
I personally don't think so. I actually just wrote an article for Homeland Security Today magazine that came out just a few days ago that is asking the question, where does border security rank among our national priorities?
Right.
Because I've been keeping up with the GOP debates over the last several months, and occasionally when they even deign to talk about border security for just a couple of minutes,
right,
they kind of use it as a springboard to move into the immigration debate. And even then, they don't really get anywhere in any solid direction. And first of all, nobody really knows how to define border security. Everybody says, well, you know, we can't talk about immigration reform until we secure the border. But if you ask any politician what that means, he or she probably isn't going to be able to tell you, because nobody has any solid benchmarks for that. And it's extremely frustrating.
Right. And, you know, and this President Obama said in El Paso a little while ago, the border is safer than it's ever been, right?
Oh, yeah. And if you ask some rancher in Texas, you know, how they feel about that, and you talk about dirty looks, you know. It's border security and the existence of spillover violence. Yeah, it's all in the eye of the beholder, because there's no standard definition, and state and local and federal agencies, they are all working off completely different sheets of music. So we're kind of at a stalemate here.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about your background and establish your credentials and expertise on this subject. Give us a little background on yourself, how you became involved with Mexican border issues.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I was a special agent with the Air Force for 8 years, and towards the end of my brief career, I went to graduate school to get my degree in Latin American studies, and that was through an Air Force program.
Mm-hmm.
So my last 2 years, I was a counterterrorism analyst, taking a look at terrorist groups in South America, mostly groups like the FARC in Colombia, the ELN, Shining Path in Peru, etc. So I already had a background in Latin America, and then I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2005 and medically retired. My husband's on active duty, so as soon as I was retired, we ended up in Northern California, and I was able to get a job in Sacramento as a contract analyst for the state. And, you know, I brought a lot of information about South America to the table there, but being a border state, they were more interested in finding out what was going on in Mexico.
Right.
So I busted my hump to be the best analyst that I could, and the most knowledgeable about anything and everything that was going on along the border, with the cartels, the kind of daily drama with the arrests and the murders, et cetera.
Right.
So I did that for 4 solid years. I mean, nothing but the drug war for 4 years, and then we had to move again to the Midwest. We're in the St. Louis area now. And I started my own company. I began my own consulting business. I learned how to become a freelance writer and just started writing some more, and slowly picked up some clients, started doing interviews, et cetera. And by that point, I had amassed so much material that a documentary director who had contacted me for some help with a project he was working on for 60 Minutes suggested, hey, have you ever thought about packaging your work for a TV pitch or a book pitch? And I was like, not really.
Right.
So that's kind of where Cartel came out of, you know, with a little bit of tweaking and a little bit of additional work, Cartel was born.
Right. And you're an expert witness on U.S. asylum cases, right? And
I am. That's actually one of the most fascinating things that I do.
Right. On that, then. We're talking about, we're going to talk about the Mexican drug war. Can you give us a little background? You know, it seems like it's in perpetual crisis over the last 5 years, since 2006, when Mexican President Felipe Calderon declared war on the cartels in 2006. Can you tell us, you know, when this give us a little background so we can understand when it's really become a huge problem for U.S. interests?
And it's really kind of funny that you mentioned December 2006, because that's kind of the accepted starting point for the media, and when folks talk about it, it's actually more complicated than that.
Right.
You know, drug trafficking in Mexico has been around since the late 1800s, when the Chinese were running heroin and opium into the United States from central Mexico. And everything was going, you know, fine, really, up until 2000, because there was one political party in power, the PRI, for 71 years in Mexico, and they ruled with an iron fist. It wasn't truly a democracy, but they were extraordinarily corrupt. So they had an agreement with the cartels for 71 years that said, you know what, we'll look the other way, you do your thing, we'll do our thing, and we'll allow you to run your drugs, but you're going to have to, you know, pay us and give us a few favors in return. Now, the difference between then and now is that back then, the government had control. If the cartel stepped out of line, if things got too ugly, there would be some government arrests, there would be some disappearances of cartel members, some folks thrown in jail, and the cartels would get back in line. So they actually feared and respected the government.
Right.
Then in 2000, the PRI was thrown out of office, and the PAN came in and true democracy took hold in Mexico. And when true democracy came in, that agreement, or Pax Mafiosa, went out. So all of a sudden, the cartels are like, hey, we're pretty much on our own. We can't count on the government to look the other way anymore. Mm-hmm. So they had to start to fight back. Now, Vicente Fox, who took office in 2000, mm-hmm. he was a little bit tougher on the cartels, but in my opinion, kind of wishy-washy in that department. So he mm-hmm. sent a few thousand army troops out, and there were several kingpins that went down during Fox's tenure. But overall, the cartels were still more or less, you know, doing business as they wanted, and we started to see things ramp up. The real turning point, in my opinion, in the drug war that really started to give it the characteristics of brutality that we see now mm-hmm. is the emergence of Los Zetas. When Ociel Cárdenas Guillén, who was the head of the Gulf cartel in several years back, in the mid-90s, he wanted to recruit his own private army to defend his operations in his territory. Mm-hmm. So he went to the best of the best and started recruiting Mexican Special Forces troops who were more than happy to take the Gulf cartel's extraordinary pay over Mexican army pay. So he formed this elite cadre of soldiers who would go out and do his bidding, you know, assassinations, mm-hmm. intimidation, you name it. So Cárdenas Guillén was arrested in 2003 and thrown mm-hmm. in jail, and he was still running the Gulf cartel from jail, but Los Zetas had a little bit more freedom to operate. So the Battle of Nuevo Laredo started in 2004, where the Gulf cartel was fighting against the Sinaloa Federation there for mm-hmm. control of that very lucrative drug route. Mm-hmm. So the Zetas were dispatched to take care of business, and that was where the beheading was introduced to the drug war. The decapitations, the dismemberments, that was where the brutality really started. And from that point on, in 2004 in Nuevo Laredo, mm-hmm. it became a game of keeping up with the Joneses. You know, the other cartels had to engage in similar behavior or more shocking behavior to keep that shock factor alive, to show that they were just as brutal, just as powerful, right. just as unafraid. And ever since then, we've started to see an escalation of the brutality, of the acts of violence, you know, the
right.
faces being skinned off and sewed onto a soccer ball, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
So when President Calderón was elected in 2006 and started sending out tens of thousands of army troops and declaring an all-out war, you know, the kindling mm-hmm. had already been set. You know, that fire had already started. Mm-hmm. The only thing is that he threw about, you know, 5,000 gallons of fuel on top of it.
And just, well, you said that the government at one time had control.
Yes.
So how powerful now are the cartels? Are they challenging the Mexican government, and are we faced with a situation where we may have a narco-democracy?
Well, they definitely operate with impunity in several parts of Mexico, and some people believe that Mexico is on the brink of being a failed state, and it's really not true. You know, they're at the local level, the government has no control in some parts of Mexico,
right.
but overall, you know, Mexico has a functioning democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, they have elections coming up on the 1st of July. Mm-hmm. They have a functioning democracy. They have a broken but an existent judicial system. They have the 13th largest economy in the world. So, you know, day-to-day in Mexico City and in various parts and various, and even in Guadalajara, things are changing mm-hmm. there a little bit, but in the main metro centers of Mexico, life is still functioning. There's still millions and billions of dollars in foreign investment and tourism, so mm-hmm. things are still kind of rolling there. You know, Mexico is still functioning as a country, just there are very specific parts of it where the cartels can pretty much do what they want, and the police are completely under their control. But
right.
I don't think you can characterize the entire country that
yeah.
way.
Yeah, it's very interesting because you know, I was in Colombia in the 80s.
Right.
And you know, when you watch media reports from the U.S., you think, oh my God, you know, and people say, what are you doing there? But you know, life goes on.
Yeah.
And you know, people live and you know, the media reports stories, but it's good news or normal news, they're not going to report it. So,
right, right.
So a lot of it is, but there's still a problem, right? I mean, I read where the money that the cartels make is more than the defense budget of the Mexican government. Is that true? And that's really staggering fact, if it is true.
Well, unfortunately, I don't know what the defense budget is. I can tell you that the UN is estimating that they're pulling in somewhere between $8 to $30 billion. But mm-hmm. you know, even that is a wide range, between $8 and $30 mm-hmm. billion. You know? But it's not like they have PricewaterhouseCoopers doing their numbers for them.
Right,
so
right.
It's, you know, it's black market, so it's only a guesstimate.
Right.
But there are some organized crime experts in Mexico who believe that dirty money coming from drugs and other illegal activities, you know, extortion, kidnapping, mm-hmm. and ransom, can total up from anywhere from 3% to 11%
wow.
of Mexico's GDP. So it's not chump change that we're talking about here.
Right. Well, what do they do with their money? Do they invest it in the country? I know they use a lot of it for bribery and for corruption, because you know it's part of the cost of doing business. But what do they do with their money?
Well, a lot of it is used to buy weapons. A lot of it is used for bribery, and then a lot of it is used to pay their foot soldiers, mm-hmm. pay their the people who work for them, and then mm-hmm. the rest of it is going towards Cadillac Escalades and gold-plated guns and girls and jewelry and clothes
right.
and all that sort of thing.
Right.
So in one way, yeah, it's being pumped into the economy, and that's why one of the reasons that I believe that Mexican anti-money laundering laws have been so weak for so long, mm-hmm. so much money is pouring into the economy that it's kind of hard to shut that off. It's like, you know, cutting off Mexico's nose to spite its face. And it's not just Mexico where we're seeing that. You know, in South Texas, there was a report that came out that somewhere over $200 million is being pumped into the South
wow.
Texas economy from cartel members who are living there and have front companies, they have homes, mm. you know, they're paying property taxes, and they're pouring it into businesses.
Right.
And if they dug hard enough, they could probably figure out where it's coming from,
right.
but there are parts of South Texas that aren't exactly wealthy, and it's kind of hard to turn that money away in tough economic times.
Right. Well, you mentioned guns. A lot of Americans are making money off the Mexican drug war, right?
Yeah, if you take a look at the gun dealers and the places where the straw buyers are purchasing their guns, it's pretty easy in some parts of the United States to buy guns and ship them south.
Right. Well, what's your view on that? Is there something that could be done about it? Because when you read reports, they say that's really fueling the drug war in Mexico.
And the gun trafficking issue is so controversial because, you know, we Americans are extraordinarily passionate about guns one way or another.
Right.
You know, the anti-gun, the pro-gun. So you have two very, very polarized sides. You know, you have groups like the NRA and other pro-gun lobby groups who firmly believe and will fight tooth and nail to show that the vast majority of guns that are being used by the cartels mm-hmm. in Mexico are coming from either within Mexico, from dirty mm-hmm. cops, from the army, deserters, or coming from Central America, Honduras, El Salvador, remnants of civil wars, or Asia, or former Eastern Bloc countries. And they have a political agenda to pursue that it's in their best interest to make sure that the American public and the Congress believes that that's true.
Right.
Then you have the U.S. government and folks on the other side of the debate who firmly believe that anywhere from 70 to 90% of the guns being used by the cartels are coming from U.S. sources and that they're just, you know, going across the border. So it's so heated. It's incredibly heated.
Right.
And no matter how I talk about it or how middle of the road I walk on this line, somebody always gets mad. But, you know, the way I look at it, I'm an analyst. You know, I
right.
have to take a look at the facts in front of me. And logic tells me that the cheap, you know, the cartels are a business, okay? Make
right.
no mistake, they are a profit-making business. And any time mm-hmm. that you're a profit-making business, your goal is to maximize those profits
right.
and reduce your overhead and your expenses as much as possible. So the cheapest, the easiest, and the fastest way for a cartel to acquire the guns that they want, their guns of choice, you know, whether pistols, rifles, AR-15s, et cetera, mm-hmm. is to buy them through the straw purchasing method in the United States
right.
and bring them south, because
right.
at best only 10% of southbound vehicles are being inspected.
Right.
You know, an AK-47 on the black market, on the street, it's more expensive in Honduras mm-hmm. than it is to get it in the United States and bring it south across the border,
right.
and it's a much shorter distance to travel. So that's what logic tells me, that's what the facts tell me. But you know, sometimes in a heated emotional
right.
debate like that, facts don't really
right.
don't really
matter.
No, so the bottom line is
sure.
nobody knows.
Right.
Nobody knows exactly how many guns are being used. Nobody knows what proportion are military grade, what proportion are handguns and pistols,
mm-hmm.
or what proportion is coming from the U.S. and coming from Central America.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of muddies everything up and makes it next to impossible
right.
to have any kind of effective anti-gun trafficking policies or legislation.
Right, and you don't see it changing in the near future.
No, I see an absolute stalemate, yet another frustration.
Right. Willie, you had a question?
I've got a question for Sylvia. You know, Ron mentioned Colombia earlier in the broadcast. It seems Colombia has managed their drug war problem. Are there any models that Mexico is using or applying to their problem? Or is there any fact-finding things between Calderon and the Colombian authorities?
They've consulted with each other. That I know. And they've talked about different strategies they can use. But a lot of people make the mistake of comparing the two and saying that it's a similar situation. You know, like the Mérida Initiative, the mm-hmm. $1.7 billion
right.
that we're sending towards the drug war. A lot of people have been calling it, you know,
Plan Colombia.
Plan Mexico, Plan
right.
Colombia, whatever.
Right.
But it's such a different situation. I mean, in Colombia, you have a officially designated foreign terrorist organization, and they actually want to take over the mm-hmm. government. They're communists, you know, Marxist-Leninists,
right.
who want to replace the government with a communist agrarian society. I mean, they're capitalist in extreme. I mean, they left Lenin, you know, long ago,
right.
back in the dust. But that's their actual goal.
Right.
Now you take a look at Mexico, and real, the ultimate goal of the cartels is to make money. You know, they don't want to take over the government. They either want to control the government or at least eliminate government interference in their affairs. So it's very different. I mean,
right.
at the most, you can say they've converted into a criminal insurgency, but even that is controversial in many circles.
Right. Before we take a break, I was just going to ask you one question. A lot of people are listening to this and programming their problem, and they'd like to go to Mexico. Is it safe for Americans? And do you go there?
I do not go there, but I'm a public figure in the sense that, you know, my writing is out there, my name,
right.
my picture
right.
and stuff, and what I do. So, you know, for my sake, for my family's sake, I prefer not to go. Plus, I'm a strategic level analyst, so it's my job to kind of pull in all
right.
the raw data from the people on the ground. So,
right.
me personally, I avoid it. However, there are many places in Mexico that are perfectly safe to go. You fly in, you stay at your resort, you know, Cabo San Lucas, Cancun, Cozumel, the Mayan ruins in Tulum. I mean, there's so many gorgeous places in Mexico. San Miguel de Allende, that has a huge American expatriate community.
Right.
But you have to be smart. You know, you have to look at the State Department, at least in the U.S. website. Take a look. Don't drive around. You know, don't drive across
right.
the border and start checking out all the scenic highways. You know, there are smart ways to travel to Mexico. Make it there, have a great time, and make
right.
it home in one piece.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Cancun. My wife's been bugging me
yeah.
to take her to Cancun. Willie, let's take a quick break and. We'll get back to our fascinating guest.
You bet. What an intriguing interview. A great guest. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsik and Will Harib. Our guest this evening is Sylvia Longmire. Now back to Ron and award-winning author, Miss Sylvia Longmire.
Thank you, Willie. And we're back with Sylvia Longmire, the author of Cartel, The Coming Invasion of Mexico's Drug Wars, and you can go to www.longmireconsulting.com. That's long, L-O-N-G, Meyer, M-I-R-E, consulting.com to get more information on our special guest. And you're on Facebook and Twitter?
I am on Facebook and Twitter. You can find me on both of them as Drug War Analyst.
Drug War Analyst. And what about tips for buying your book? I would imagine it's all over the place.
It is all over the place. You can, and in the U.S., you can get it at a Barnes & Noble bookstore in various places. You can get it on Amazon in both Canada and the United States on iPad and iTunes, Sony e-reader, Nook. It's pretty available.
Right. And international as well, too.
Yes, in Japan, wherever Amazon has a site, you can pretty
right.
much, even in Australia.
Right. We got listeners all over the world, so that's I'm sure they're happy to hear about that. Now, getting back to our fascinating interview, what about U.S. advisors? Is there any U.S. president in Mexico? Because, you know, in Colombia there were
right.
there were advisors. Is it the same situation there, or has the United States been very careful to stay out of Mexico because of the you know, the sentiment of the Mexican people.
Yes and yes. there are civilian trainers. Relatively speaking, it's only a handful. I believe it's only maybe 160, 200, something like that, who are working with the police. It used to be that the U.S. military has a bigger role than people might think, and they purposely keep that quiet as far as providing training and equipment. They've actually kind of turned away from that with the latest revamping of the Mérida initiative. They decided that it's best to focus more on training and helping police at the state and local level because that's where they're having the most trouble. The least corrupt of all the institutions in Mexico that are trying to deal with the drug war are the federal police and the military. So he said, okay, let's go where the biggest challenges lie. So they're kind of revamping that a little.
But the
U.S. Department of Defense does have a role in providing training and equipment. So, and as far as the advisors, it's mostly retired. I think it's retired military, retired FBI, other folks who have just a long line or list of experience that are down there in an advisory role, and hopefully they're having a big impact.
Right. Well, you mentioned your work regarding terrorism, and I know you and your husband published an article called "Redefining Terrorism: Why Mexican Drug Cartels Are More Than Just Organized Crime." And that was published in a prestigious journal. Is there any connection between terrorists, who are wanting to do harm to the United States, and drug traffickers in Mexico, or can they be the same thing?
I don't believe that there is, and that's for a very, very simple reason, is that connection would be very, very bad for drug cartel business. That's not to say that there aren't members of terrorist groups that are in Mexico waiting to come across. There are special interest aliens that pay much higher sums of money to coyotes who specialize in smuggling these special interest aliens, meaning people who are from countries that are affiliated with terrorism in some way, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, etc. And we know that members of Hezbollah have come across the southwest border. The way I look at it, and I wrote an article about this for Homeland Security Today as well, it's like we have thousands and thousands of members of Hezbollah already living in the United States, and they've been here for a while. They're selling...
Thousands and thousands?
Oh, yeah. And this always, I love how it just comes as a surprise because nobody really talks about it or writes about it.
Yeah,
and it's kind of like an open secret. It's like, who do you think is selling fake purses in New York City, you know?
And they're illegal, and are they, full-fledged terrorists?
Well, that's the question, you know. It's like, remember, Hezbollah, especially in South America and particularly in the tri-border area, Hezbollah is considered a legitimate political party in other parts of the world,
that's
so
right.
is Hamas.
That's right.
So you say somebody's a member of Hezbollah, you kind of have to ask the question. The important thing for our national security is, do they just provide financial support, which the vast majority of them do, or are they here with an operational capacity? Are they coming across the border with the intent to blow something up? And that's obviously the main concern. Well, now, of the members of Hezbollah that have crossed the border, to my knowledge, there has been nobody in an operational capacity who has used the southwest border to come in. They're just coming to join the rest of their friends or family or associates or whatever in a particular city or town, and possibly they have no nefarious intentions, or they're engaging in just criminal, typical criminal behavior to raise money, and that money goes back towards the organization in the Middle East.
Right. Well, that's really amazing. This guy down the street has a beard. I looked at him kind of suspiciously the other day. I'm going to look at him again. Maybe he's got one of these characters that are going across the border. But, the Mexican drug cartels have established roots and all that, and, they don't like the United States. What's stopping them from selling them access to these routes or helping them, because they think it might further their aims in the war on drugs. I mean, and ultimately there's the suitcase bomb, that elephant in the room that everybody always talks about getting into the United States, doing a radioactive cloud. What about that?
Well, remember that The drug cartels, you know, obviously keeping the money flow going is the biggest thing.
Right.
The government of Mexico, it is also their number one interest to make sure that the U.S. does not, you know, it's not possible to shut down the border, but
right.
It is in their best interest to make sure that the United States does not come as close as humanly possible to shutting down the border, number one. Number two, they want to avoid any kind of military incursion by the United States,
mm-hmm.
you know, at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
If the cartels were, and they know this, you know, the cartels are smart, okay? These are not, you know, dumb street
right.
punks, okay? They are extremely smart and good at what they do. If they were to allow their routes or their tunnels, I mean, they hardly allow human smugglers to use them, and if they do allow them to use them, it's at a very, very high price.
Right.
If they were to allow terrorists, you know, active operational terrorists mm-hmm. to use one of their routes or even to assist them, and either the Mexican government were to get whiff of it or the U.S. government were to get whiff of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, you talk about justification.
Bad public relations.
Yeah, you talk about justification for U.S.
Right.
military involvement in Mexico. You know, not only would that be horrible for Mexican foreign investment,
right.
for Mexican tourism, you know, Mexican, mm-hmm. just the cross-border
right.
economy. I mean, you know, it's billions
right.
of dollars a day that are crossing the border. And you know, it would be an absolute disaster. And you talk about shutting down a cartel's operations,
right.
billions of dollars out the window because they decided, oh, okay, well,
yeah.
you know, let's
right.
give this guy a hand in crossing the border. So it's really in nobody's best interest to allow that to happen. And
right.
you know, and I've taken a look at both borders. Why, if you were a terrorist and you wanted to come in the United States, why would you use one of the most heavily scrutinized and fortified borders in the country when you can come in through Canada? I mean, taking a look at the northern border and the lack of security there, I mean, but then again, there's not a drug war going on in Canada either, and there's
right.
not, you know, hundreds of thousands of Canadians who are trying to come across the border into the United States illegally every year. So it's
right.
a totally different situation. But if I were a terrorist, I wanted to come to the United States, I would come in through Canada, or I would just fly in.
Right. So
I got a quick one for Sylvia, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
You know, drugs, as everybody knows, or not everybody knows, but drugs are only a part of cartels' operations. I think maybe 50%. Describe to our listeners, Sylvia, the other areas they're involved in, like kidnapping, extortion.
Yeah, kidnapping and extortion.
Oil theft, of all things.
Yeah, all sorts of, and some crazy stuff. Los Zetas is probably the cartel that has expanded the most into other areas. So yeah, kidnapping and extortion is a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And groups like Los Zetas now are targeting not just rivals and snitches and stuff for that. They are targeting innocent people, and they're targeting business owners who don't pay their monthly or their weekly tax. And increasingly, they are targeting migrants. Innocent migrants who are helpless and just on their way north to the border, and they'll snatch them up and they'll make them contact their family members here in the United States and force them to pay the ransom. And if they can't pay the ransom, then they execute them, and it's to them it's no big deal. So that brings in a lot of money to them. They're also involved in fuel theft, tapping pipelines in Mexico.
Wow.
The estimate is that Pemex is losing as much as $700 million a year to fuel theft, organized crime, and just to criminal bandits and smaller criminal groups.
Right.
They're involved in piracy of CDs and DVDs and software.
Right.
The Motion Picture Association of America is estimating that Hollywood is losing up to $600 million a year in movie piracy. And in software, something like it's millions of dollars that they're losing in software piracy. Even cattle rustling. I know that sounds totally crazy, but some of the stuff that these folks will do for money, they're involved now in mining operations for different mines throughout Mexico. Anywhere that there is some kind of industry where money can be made through theft or graft or extortion
right.
or something like that, you can probably find organized crime's hand in.
Right. So even if theoretically the so-called war on drugs was won, they'd find something to do. They would still be in business in some criminal aspect, right?
Sure. I mean, obviously their profits would go way down, but you know, take a look at Al Capone and
yeah, that's right.
And the organized crime in the 20s and 30s. You know, after Prohibition was lifted, it's
right.
not like they disappeared and went away.
Right.
I mean, organized crime is still alive and well in the United States.
Right.
It just has a different face now. That's
right.
All.
Right. Well, Willie, let's take another short break, and then we want to finish our interview with Time's Flying here. We'll talk a little bit about the subtitle, The Coming Invasion of Mexico's Drug Wars, to find out where the cartels are. Then we'll talk a little bit about what Sylvia, our guest, thinks about what we need to do in order to improve the situation. Willie?
You bet, Ronnie. What a fascinating interview. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Your hosts are Ron Shepsik and yours truly. Now back to Ron and Sylvia.
Right. We're back with Sylvia Longmire, the author of Cartel, The Coming Invasion of Mexico's Drug Wars, published by Paul Gray Macmillan. And you can go to her website, www.longmireconsulting.com. That's Longmire, L-O-N-G-M-I-R-E, consulting.com. She's on Facebook and Twitter. You could easily track her down. And the book's available pretty well anywhere in the world. And like I said, it's a good read. It's a stimulating read. And it'll provide really great background on an important policy issue for the United States. And as I mentioned, the subtitle is The Coming Invasion of Mexico's Drugs War. So where are the cartels here in the United States? I read one report there were in 230 cities. Is that true?
Oh, it's more than that. Actually, that came from the 2010 National Drug Intelligence Center report. The 2011 report says that they have a presence either directly or by proxy, meaning people they've, wow, they've subcontracted out to, more than 1,000 U.S. cities.
Right.
So, you know, they're already here as far as presence goes. 90% of the illegal drugs that are consumed by Americans are coming from Mexico.
Right.
So, you know, if you want to find them, it's not that tough. Plus, they're growing marijuana in over a dozen U.S. states in our taxpayer-funded national parks and national forests.
Wow.
Actually, I just got a news report sent to me today that two Mexican nationals who were sentenced to 10 years in jail for running marijuana grow operations in Wisconsin. And many Americans here would be stunned to find out that that marijuana is being grown by Mexican cartels in Wisconsin, but that's the case. Now, as far as the coming invasion goes, you know, the way I look at it is not as like a war of the worlds, you know, bombs going off and explosions and stuff
right.
everywhere. I look at it more of like a virus.
Yeah.
And it's a slow thing, and we're already starting to see it in the southwest border states. Now, the thing is, despite the growing violence and the drug seizures and everything, we are having an impact on cartel operations. They are getting squeezed. And the cartels, the more that they get squeezed, the more desperate that they become to keep those profits coming in.
Right.
And you see groups like Los Zetas who are becoming bolder and bolder and already have people here in the United States. And they're starting to engage, they're more willing to engage in violent behavior, not just with each other, but with U.S. law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Just in the last 4 months, we've seen several incidents where they have confronted each other or U.S. law enforcement, particularly in Texas, that have been really surprising. And just, we've never seen so many back-to-back incidents.
Wow.
And my concern is that if we don't start looking at it as a national priority, because right now I think it's at the bottom, towards the bottom of the totem pole, if we don't start looking at it as a national priority and keep saying that, oh, you know, the border is as safe and secure as it's ever been, which means, you know, nobody gives anything about it, then nothing is going to change, nothing more is going to be done about it, and that that violence creep is going to keep coming, and it's going
right.
to get worse until it's too late.
Right. Has there any figures on how much the crime rate has increased because of this presence of Mexican drug cartel associates in the United States?
Well, that's the problem, is that the U.S. government is saying that overall crime on the southwest border has decreased by 30%. The problem is they're taking those statistics from the FBI's Uniform Crime Report database,
right.
and there are almost an infinite number of ways that you can pull those statistics. You can pull them from by population, by county, by city, and if you pull them in a certain way, if you just take a look at border cities like El Paso and San Diego, which are definitely safe, they're some of the safest places in the whole country. I have
right.
no argument with that. But if you start taking a look across the board, including the more rural parts of
right.
Texas and Arizona,
right.
you start looking across the board at all the communities, and it paints a very, very different picture. So
right.
statistics are a good place to start, but they can be manipulated in a number of ways
right.
to fit almost anybody's
right.
agenda.
Right, and you were mentioning the border. I don't think we have to stop there. I read where Phoenix has had such an increase in kidnappings that the city has formed a special task force.
Yeah, and that was a controversy actually a couple of years ago. They reported,
right.
for 2009, they reported, I think, 359 kidnappings, and it turned out that they had pumped up the numbers and manipulated their stats because they
right.
wanted more funding from the federal government, more grant money. But even after they completely cleaned out the system and recategorized everything and
right.
just, you know, made it on the, put it on the up and up, it was still something like 260 kidnappings. So they still
oh,
have
wow.
a problem, no matter how you want to, you know, paint it or you know, you fix the numbers and it's still really bad. Now, now. The good news is, or if you want to call it good news, that the vast majority of those kidnappings are criminal on criminal. You know, they're going after, you know, they're going after rivals or snitches or something like that. But they're increasingly going after illegal immigrants, and they're not going to report anything to police they're afraid of getting
deported. And the innocent people get killed.
Yes,
I mean, in crossfires and violence and that sort of thing.
That's right. That's right.
Right on that sort of thing. Well, we mentioned illegal immigration, and you've referred to it. What does that have to do with the Mexico's drug problems and the U.S. Policy towards it?
Well, unfortunately, at least in my opinion, I believe that people tend to get the two situations confused, or they believe that one is a result of the other, or the problem is one of the same. And it's very unfortunate because they are two distinct and separate issues, especially when it comes to taking a look at solutions. You know, you have a lot of people, you know, at least statistically speaking, we have less illegal immigrants coming across the border or being apprehended than we ever have before, and that's for a variety of different reasons. But it's extremely challenging for Border Patrol to distinguish sometimes between the two. The problem is that Border Patrol has to go after whoever they can get to, and there's no real prioritization for different reasons. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in my opinion, I think it's more important to go after you have criminals, violent criminals who are bringing illegal drugs across the border, and that is the priority. Then you have immigrants who are coming because they want to make a better life for themselves. Mm-hmm. And you can debate that till the cows come home and take a look at the DREAM Act and everything, but they're two very distinct issues. And right now the problem is that immigrants are getting caught up in the drug war because they are being targeted for kidnapping and ransom. They're being forced at gunpoint to bring drug loads across the river because they're threatened with death or with death of their family members if they don't do it, because that reduces the amount of risk posed to the actual trafficker, because if the immigrant gets caught, at worst, you know, they lose a load, but at least the drug trafficker isn't the one who ends up going to jail. They couldn't care less if an immigrant gets busted or goes to jail or dies in the process.
Right.
So they are being pulled into the drug war, but it's very important for people to know that illegal immigration and drug smuggling and the drug war, they touch upon each other. They overlap in some cases, but they are two different issues that need to be treated differently.
Right.
Yeah, I've got a quick one.
Well, we're moving on. Go ahead, because we've got
just
only
a quick
4 minutes.
One, yeah. Sylvia, is there any evidence down there with the cartels that they're developing pacts between each other, like the mafia did in the 40s?
Oh, sure. Yeah, they've been doing that for decades on and off. You know, right now we're seeing kind of a polarization going on in Mexico between the Sinaloa Federation and alliances that they have. You know, they're aligning with smaller cartels, particularly groups, and then the CEPAs, who are aligning with, say, like the South Pacific cartel and aligning with other factions, because those are temporary. You know, it works till their best interest. You had an alliance between the old La Familia and the Sinaloa Federation and the Gulf Cartel to fight Los Zetas, and it was called the New Federation, and that dissolved after a while. So it's kind of like a soap opera. You know, it comes and goes, and who knows what those alliances are going to look like in 6 months or a year from now, but it serves a very strategic purpose.
Right. And you mentioned Zetas. That's spelled Z or Z in Canada, E-T-A-S.
Yes, sir.
Right. And like I said, we want to get to what you think can be done to change the situation. And I know in your book you write about managing the drug situation in Mexico and the drug war. Can you explain a little bit about that and what you think needs to be done?
Sure. I mean, a lot of people ask me, you know, can we win this war? Can the war be won? Is Mexico winning? There is no win or lose here, right? This is not...
We got to change the metaphor. War on drugs, that implies there are winners and losers.
Right.
And that makes it almost impossible to solve then, right?
Right. It, you know, it's not the Civil War. You don't have... it's not World War II. You don't have a clear endpoint.
Right.
You know, and besides, what if Mexico defines victory different than the United States defines victory? You know, your partner's in this thing, and it's too subjective. What I mean by manageable is, like, we have manageable crime here in the United States. You have manageable crime in Canada. You know, you have certain cities that are more violent than others, but the bottom line is that the average American can go to work every day, they can take their kids to school, they can go to the supermarket to buy their groceries without having to worry about getting caught in the middle of crossfire. If you call the police, the police are going to come. You know, that may take a little bit longer in some places, but you can generally rely on the police to do their jobs and the courts and attorneys and everything to prosecute the bad guys. That is not the case in Mexico right now. So it's the Mexican government's job to bring drug trafficking or at least the drug-related violence down to a level where the Mexican government can have confidence in their police, confidence in their justice system, and have that safety and security to go outside of their homes and go to whatever restaurant they want to eat in or go whatever store at whatever time of night they want to go to in a degree of safety. Now, as far as how to get there, the obvious solution, or at least the simple yet most complicated solution, either you end drug demand in the United States, which is never going to happen, or you legalize, you know, methamphetamine, marijuana, heroin, and cocaine across the board from production to consumption, and that's not going to happen anytime soon either. So you're left with taking a look at other solutions. Personally, right now, and a lot has evolved since I finished writing the book almost a year ago, before when it went to press. And now, because you have the Sinaloa issue and the Cetas issue, the Cetas are the biggest threat in Mexico and, in my opinion, the biggest cartel threat to the United States. Sinaloa is old school. They're enormous, and they go about things the old-fashioned way like the Italian mafia used to and probably still does here in the United States. So probably one of the best things the Mexican government can do is get rid of Los Cetas and let Sinaloa take over. But how can you do that out in the open? You know, the Mexican government's already been accused of favoring the Sinaloa Federation, but maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Wow.
So maybe if you have one mega cartel in charge of everything, while it's not sort of an implicit agreement, but not really, at least you reduce the violence, and that's your number one goal. Mm-hmm. You go after the drug trafficking later, but try to slow down the killing so the Mexican government, Mexican people feel safe again.
Well, you've really given a really good background to this important issue, and we hope to have you back as because I'm sure this issue is going to be around for a long time when you do your next book and on the issue. We're talking with Sylvia Longmire, the author of Cartel, The Coming Invasion of Mexico's Drug Wars. And you can get the book pretty well everywhere. It's published by Paul Gray McMillan. And you go to our website, www.longmireconsulting.com. Sylvia Longmire, thank you for being a great guest and explaining
the
complex issue.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Right. And we hope to have you back on again.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. And Willie.
Yeah, well, thanks, Ronnie, and thanks again to our special guest, Sylvia Longmire. We needed 4 hours with Sylvia tonight. we're privileged to have her on our program. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about our interview tonight?
Well, I learned that our guest really knows what she's talking about, and I hope that maybe some of our leaders were listening to the show because they got to wake up to this issue. They're sleeping at the switch, and... hopefully Sylvia's book will continue to stir debate on the subject. Willie, how about you?
Well, you know, Ronnie, I learned that there's an insatiable appetite on the American side. It's an unbelievable demand. Americans are the largest consumer of illicit drugs in the world, and it's got to stop in the lower 48 states, man. The so-called war on drugs declared by Richard Nixon 40 years ago was an abject failure. You know, I don't think you could ever stop the drugs and deadly activity that's happening. So it could be managed, I suppose, as Sylvia mentioned.
Right.
But it's a fascinating story.
Right.
A great book.
And you talk about U.S. demand, according to UN, I read one report, it's like 45% of all drugs in the world are consumed by the American market.
Unbelievable. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat Dumb Crook of the Month segment. This one is too good to be true, Ronnie. We should call it Smart Crook of the Month segment. Get a load of this. A 31-year-old woman serving a life sentence in a Swedish prison is demanding vacation time away from her job she had inside the facility. Natalia Peshkina, who was convicted of her ex-boyfriend's murder in 2005, said she took a job inside the prison in 2010, and she believes she's due compensation for the paid vacation time required by Swedish labor laws. Well, Ronnie, I'll give Natalia A for effort. Any comments on this ingenious way to get out of the slammer?
Well, I'll tell you, in the U.S., it'd be thrown out of court pretty quickly, but Sweden is kind of strange. I did a little research. They got a law in the books that says where prostitution is legal in Sweden, but it's illegal to procure the services of a prostitute. So maybe she'll use the mumbo-jumbo of Swedish laws to her advantage. Is that a Ukrainian name, by the way?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I it's a Russian name, as far as I know.
Okay, I thought she was a sister.
What a fascinating story. Yeah. Now, just a reminder for all your listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for February the 16th, where we'll have our special guest, Mr. Evan Wright, co-author of American Desperado, My Life from Mafia Soldier to Cocaine Cowboy to Secret Government Asset. Wright will discuss the remarkable life of John Roberts, the de facto transportation chief of the Medellin cartel during the 1980s. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we would like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. And please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chapsick and myself, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.